All right, we'll call the Energy, Utilities, and Telecom Committee of February 21st, 2012 to order. We do not have a quorum currently, so we'll have to wait for a quorum to take any action. First up is Senate File 1788. Senator Howe, I see your bill has a fiscal note. All those opposed signify by saying nay. Nay. Okay, we're done with that
Mr.
bill.
Mr. Chair.
Oh, I'm sorry, Senator Howe. I was just having a little fun with you since there wasn't a quorum. Senator Howe.
Mr. Chair, I'd like to discuss Senate File 1788. It's a bill relating to Public Utility Commission Regulatory Burden Study. I have a couple of testifiers here. I'd like to what this bill does, commissions a study to do away with some of the redundant reporting, and I do have a an amendment that we're going to have to wait to offer until there's a quorum, but certainly we can have Ms. Bergen testify while we're waiting for the additional committee members.
Thank you, Senator Howe. Ms. Bergen, if you'd like to proceed.
Yes, thank you, Senator Jungbauer. I'd like to thank the Senate Energy and Utilities and Communications Committee for having me here to testify on this bill. Again, my name is Deb Bergen. I serve as manager of state legislative relations for Missouri River Energy Services. Missouri River is a municipal power agency that provides wholesale service to 61 member communities in four states, Minnesota, Iowa, and the Dakotas. And the bulk of our members are located here in Minnesota, with 24 of our member electric communities in this state. All 61 of our members are municipal-owned electric utilities, and they, like Missouri River Energy, are not-for-profit and customer-owned, and all of our electric rates are cost-based. Minnesota utilities and municipal power agencies like Missouri River Energy are moving forward on many fronts. We are building renewable generation to meet the renewable energy standard. We are planning other generation reliability projects. We are planning to meet state energy efficiency goals, and we're building new transmission. Unfortunately, we've become, like other utilities, frustrated with some of the duplication redundancy with agency requirements on these fronts. For example, if you look just at the renewable energy standard, which requires Minnesota utilities to meet 25% demand with renewable resources by 2025, it's not the standard itself, but it's some of the compliance with that standard. In order to show compliance with that one standard, we are required to file an annual renewable energy standard report with the PUC. That's approximately 15 pages long, and it takes our legal staff about 15 days of prep work. There's also the tracking of renewable energy credits in a separate docket, the MRETS, Midwest Renewable Energy Tracking System. That's also an annual report. That's approximately 5 pages long, takes our legal in-house staff about 3 days of prep work. In addition to the RES itself, there is a CBEG goal, Community-Based Energy Development Goal, of 800 megawatts for the state. And so the utilities must file a separate quarterly report with the Division of Energy Resources showing how much of their RES comes from CBEG projects. These are usually 2 pages in length. Now, I will grant that right now Missouri River Energy Services has minimum time into that because we have not added any seabed since 2009. So our information really hasn't changed since then. But we're still filing that quarterly report. Then we also file an integrated resource plan roughly every two, for MRES anyway, it's roughly every 2 to 3 years since we're not required to file as often as some of the other utilities. But still, our IRP still has to show our plans to meet the RES. And now we also have the additional renewable impact study, rate impact study in it, which the rate impact study alone takes about 10 days for us to do that study. The IRP itself takes us several months to put together and do all of the modeling, the requirements, and then to write it up. And then there's a qualifying facilities report under Minnesota rules on customer-owned renewable generation. Now, MRES doesn't prepare that, but each of our 24 municipal communities do, and that takes each of them a couple of days. So this adds up over time in each year. in-house. So what SF 1788 does is it doesn't change any of the requirements of CBED, the Renewable Energy Standard, SIP, the IRP. It doesn't change any of that itself. We still need to meet 25 by 25. We're still moving ahead on CBED goals. It doesn't change any of that for the utilities. What it does is it would ask the PUC to open a docket where the utilities can come together with staff and work together to determine and produce a study for the legislature to determine where we can get rid of some of the redundancy, where we can maybe streamline some of these reports, and therefore make the information much more efficient as well as accessible to the public and other groups like the Minnesota Chamber of Commerce to see what the utilities are doing, why they're doing it, and to do so in a more efficient manner. And that's really what it does. It doesn't change the requirements. It just changes the compliance or the showing of the requirement, meeting the requirements. We support SF 1788 because we think it's a fair and consistent way to encourage utility and stakeholder participation across the board. We recognize that this may add some short-term workload to staff. However, our goal is to work with staff to make sure the most relevant and pertinent information is available to them in the most immediate and efficient way. And we see this legislation as an important step in removing extraneous filings in order to ensure that the bigger items get done faster. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Bergen. I have a question. In terms of the reports that are due, it'd be helpful for several of the different utilities to be able to give us members lists of those reports and the approximate amount of time that those reports take, and that would be as we move bills like this or this bill forward so that we can understand the amount of reporting and the amount of days necessary to put those things together, maybe people hours. If you mentioned quite a few that I was jotting, I actually couldn't jot them down as fast as you were mentioning reports. So, Ms. Bergen, that would be very helpful to get that information as much as we could.
I can certainly produce it for MRES. I would, of course, have to request that from other utilities. They would have to produce their own list.
Right. Any other questions for Ms. Bergen? Okay. Did we have a quorum yet? No. Need one more. All right. Still waiting. All right. Mr. Sullivan, did you?
No.
Were you going to testify?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, no, I was just here in case a question came.
Okay. So we have Peter Brickweed that wanted to testify as well.
Mr. Chairman. Members, Peter Brickwoody from the Department of Commerce. Some quick comments. And first of all, thank you to Senator Howe for bringing this forward. And I think this piece of legislation highlights an issue that's been an ongoing piece of conversation between the department and the Division of Energy Resources staff and utilities of all types here in Minnesota. I think that at the end of the day, you know, if we're able to identify specific issues that some of the utilities, in this case MRES, for example, have with reporting requirements, we can identify them. And, you know, to the extent that there are issues that we can identify that reduce workload on their end and reduce workload on our end, that's a win for us. And so if at the end of the day this piece of legislation sparks that conversation or is part of that conversation, we would be grateful to Senator Howe for bringing it forward. I think we spoke with Senator Howe afterwards, and I don't want to address the amendment before it's before the committee, but I think it is helpful, and we'd look forward to working with the author as this moves forward.
Well, let the record reflect that we do have a quorum now, and we can address the handout and address the amendment. So I'll wait a few minutes so everybody gets a chance to get the amendment and take a look. Thank you.
Mr. Chairman.
So,
If I may, just as members are getting a copy of the amendment, perhaps the only thing that I would add is these types of conversations do occur between the department and utilities on a fairly regular basis. In fact, we are having an ongoing set of conversations regarding filing requirements with a number of G&Ts. And so these types of things happen all the time, and we're eager to have those types of conversations because to the extent that we can identify filing requirements that are duplicative or we could find a way to reduce workload on both sides, we'd like to do that. And so perhaps by way of an open invitation in the committee room to utilities who have those types of questions, we'd be happy to talk with them outside of the legislation.
Well, then, Mr. Brickweed, have you had a chance to look at the fiscal note?
I have not, Mr. Chairman.
It's interesting. It has a... What do we have here? $66,000 fiscal note for FY13, and if we're it seems that if we're having those kind of conversations already, and given the amount of monies that the utilities tend to put forward for the reports they're putting forward today, it seems like this should be something that could just fit in. Based on your testimony and others, what's already going on,
Mr. Chairman? I would defer to the Public Utilities Commission to speak to their fiscal note, but they were part of the conversation that we had with Senator Howe on Friday, and so I would defer to them to speak to those costs.
Thank you. Senator Howe, the author's amendment is before us. Would you care to move it?
I'll move the A2 amendment.
Senator Howe moves the A2 amendment as an author's amendment, and this is the first committee hearing, so it's... automatically moved on to your bill, Senator Howe. So if you could speak to the amendment, the A2 amendment.
I'm going to have Joe Sullivan here speak to the amendment on it.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is, again, Joe Sullivan. I represent Missouri River Energy Services. The idea behind the changes here was first that what we wanted to make sure is that under 216 that we were including the rules under that have been promulgated under 216. So that's why we have on page 1, line 8, it includes related rules. So that is bringing in everything under there. And secondly, the idea behind basically requiring this every 10 years or the decennial review is that, you know, that this housekeeping would happen at a regular interval, but not to the point where it would be burdensome or onerous.
Any questions?
Chairman.
Senator Metzen.
Mr. Chairman, members, where does it talk in either in the bill or the amendment of the appropriation of $66,000?
Senator Howell.
And I'll, Mr. Chair I'll speak
and Senator
to that
Metzen, it doesn't. I know that when we ask agencies to do certain things that we get a fiscal note back on it, I kind of probably see where you're heading with that, but go ahead.
I think you'd, Mr. Chairman,
Senator
Howell, you've heard this speech at other committees from me, but every time the legislature asked department or somebody to do something, we have to add a person or two people or 12 people or eight people or a half a person. And it sounds like a broken record of those that have listened to me over the years. I just say do it. You know, you've got the staff. I don't think every time we add an assignment to a, not this particular one, but some departments have 1,800, 2,400 people. If you can't find a half a person, to just do it. So that's my sermon for the afternoon. But I don't think you need an appropriation. I think if this is important, which I think it is, they should do it.
Thank you, Senator Metzen. I say amen to that as well. But we have Dan Wolf.
Mr. Wolf, Mr. Chairman, I'm sure he's going to agree with me on this one.
Mr. Chairman, committee members, Dan Wolf, Assistant Executive Secretary with the Minnesota Public Utilities Commission, and Senator Metzen, actually we do, and I think the fiscal note does as well. I don't have a copy of it, but Senator Howe provided me one. We do say that we can absorb the costs.
I didn't see. Okay.
All the note was trying to indicate is that there's a incremental cost in terms of a formal procedure. You know, clearly it's a policy decision for the committee to decide whether to do this on an informal basis or do it on a more formal basis. We were simply trying to point out that on a more formal basis, you'd have some administrative costs, commissioner time, perhaps referral to an ALJ. So there's some incremental cost. Primarily, it's going to be lost opportunity cost. If you're doing this, you're not doing something else. There's only so many days within a work week. So, but we did indicate that there'd be no appropriation necessary, that it could be absorbed within our function.
Thank you, Mr. Wolf.
Chairman, I didn't catch that in the back page there. But.
Nor did I, Senator Metzen.
Okay.
Senator Benson, you were?
I no longer need to comment. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Senator Benson. And Senator Howe, I apologize. I missed that as well. So that's a good thing for this bill.
I'm for it, no.
You explained it right away. No money.
Okay, any other questions? Senator Howe?
Mr. Chair, Mr. Chair, I was going to ask for this to be re-referred to finance, but since sitting here looking at this, it doesn't appear that the fiscal note is going to be absorbed by the agency, so there would not be a need to send it to finance.
It doesn't need to go to finance. Okay.
I think that's correct.
Okay. So what would be your wishes then, Senator Howe?
Ask that it be moved and sent to the Senate floor.
Senator Howe moves Senate File 1788 as amended be recommended to pass and move directly to the Senate floor. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Those opposed? Motion carries. Thank you, Senator Howe.
You put the amendment on?
Yeah. Oh, wait, did he? Ask him,
sure. You did.
Yes, he moved the amendment.
We did move the amendment.
Yes.
Yes, he did.
Well, next, members, we will be moving on to the continued discussion of the Renewable Development Fund. And we have a number of testifiers today. Steve Kelly, Senior Policy Fellow at the Humphrey School of Public Affairs, is our first testifier. So we'll move right into that. Next one up is Jonathan Foley, if you want to be ready. Thank you. Senator Kelly.
Mr. Chairman and members of the committee, I'm Steve Kelly. I'm the director of the Center for Science, Technology, and Public Policy at the Humphrey School of Public Affairs, the Public Affairs School of the University of Minnesota. And I'm here today with several other hats. My center is a recipient of renewable development funding through the Initiative on Renewable Energy and the Environment. I want that disclosure on the record. And also, I'm an XL ratepayer, so I'm here wearing that hat as well. And I want to address five main points in my testimony today. At the hearing last week, Mr. Evans used a term that's currently considered to be pejorative with respect to the allocation of research funds to the University of Minnesota from the Renewable Development Fund. He called that allocation an earmark, which I think was intended to smear it with all of the negative implications that term has come to acquire. Back in 2003, when I was looking at the expenditures from the Renewable Development Fund and saw that to the extent any of it was funding research, it happened to be funding research in Colorado rather than at the University of Minnesota. So I suggested to Senator Anderson, who was authoring a bill at that time related to energy policy, that maybe we ought to steer some of the renewable development funding to the University of Minnesota. And also at that time, there was not much in the way of renewable energy research going on at the University of Minnesota. Senator Anderson and then Senator Murphy agreed that was a good idea and incorporated significant funding for research at the University of Minnesota in the bill that passed in 2003. Now, earmarks typically are measures that benefit an individual legislator or members of Congress district or home state. And it should be noted that none of the funding that's gone to the University of Minnesota has ever benefited or been spent in Senate District 44, which is what I usually used to represent. So if it is an, if this was an earmark, I was a particularly incompetent legislator in terms of failing to steer money to my district, or it's not an earmark. Or if it is an earmark, it's an earmark that benefits all of the citizens of Minnesota and not any particular citizen or particular entity. And I think that is the more appropriate way to think about this allocation of research funding to the University of Minnesota. Secondly, I think the language in the draft ignores some interconnections that exist. So, for example, it emphasizes spending resources on electrical energy, renewable electrical energy efficiency, but it doesn't take much to think about the fact that a plug-in hybrid electric car can use either the electrical energy or the petroleum energy for moving forward. It's a trade-off. And so anything that improves the fuel efficiency of that car will actually reduce the potential demand for electrical energy. Similarly, some members were on a trip to Berlin last year to hear about energy policy in Germany, and one of the things that we heard over and over again was the concept of methanation, of using renewable energy power to create methane and then store that in the natural gas storage facilities as a way of storing power from renewable sources. Well, once the methane is in that system, the gas stove that burns that doesn't care whether it was made from plants millions of years ago or whether it was made from wind energy, electrical energy, just a few days ago. So trying to separate out electrical energy from other kinds of energy seems to me to be a fruitless effort and sort of denying the way the energy system works. The other set of interconnections is that as a Xcel ratepayer, I also happen to be a Lake Country Power ratepayer. And any expenditures that benefit that lower my costs in the Lake Country Power Service territory also benefit me. I'm trying to say that just we're going to focus in on particular group of people in their particular geographic location misses the fact that Minnesotans have interests all over the state and that we all are affected by the costs of energy and the availability and reliability of energy wherever it exists in the state. So I think it's important to reflect on those interconnections. Third point is that the process that IRE uses is unique, and I disagree with the legislative auditor that you can allocate these resources to research and to the development of actual construction projects with the same process. And I would also disagree with Mr. Evans and Xcel Energy to the extent that they assert that their process will work equally well for the evaluation of scientific research grants. One of the reasons that IRE has been able to get so many proposals from scientists at the university is that the process looks like the same process they go through with the National Science Foundation or the Department of Energy or other research grants with similar kinds of peer review. And external entities in the private sector, like Princeton Energy, can't get access to the same kinds of peer reviewers that are available in the academic system. And, you know, that there are positives and negatives to that. But the truth is that the university's transaction costs in getting review of these scientific proposals are going to be much lower than any external entities will be, and will also be more effective because there's people participate in the peer review process on a quid pro quo basis. You know, if you're involved, if you're seeking a grant at one time, you as a scientist might on another project be one of the reviewers. So there are folks who participate in that system that Xcel Energy and an external consultant could not get access to. So one of the benefits to the state of Minnesota from using the IRE process is that you get a much more extensive, effective, and lower-cost peer review process for scientific research grants than you would get if you told scientists that they had to participate in a more political process run by an external consultant. The fourth point I want to make is that, as Mr. Hemmingson was pointing out last week, the IRE process is working, and at least when I was getting my basic investment and or gambling advice, it was to let your winners run and cut your losses. And in this case, since IRE is actually working, common sense would suggest that we ought to keep it. We've got something that we know has produced outstanding results from a research perspective, but also in terms of investment by other research entities like the Department of Energy, like the National Science Foundation. The grant that I'm involved in, the Center for Sustainable Polymers, received funding from IRE, but then received $1.5 million from the National Science Foundation in a Phase 1 grant for a project that makes it eligible for a grant for $4 million a year over 5 years. So the potential is that the initial IRE investment could, if we're successful in the grant application, bring in significant amounts to Minnesota for research on sustainable polymers. Lastly, Mr. Chairman and members, it's important to think long term. And I know that this is an election year, and there are a lot of systems out there pressuring us to pay attention to jobs and projects today. But it is important to think long-term, and I know people might have lots of different explanations for why we have a renewable development fund, but I was in the legislature in 1993 when we first passed this, and I always thought that the renewable development fund was a commitment to our children and grandchildren that after at some point, the nuclear power plants will be shut down because they were not designed to last forever, that we needed to have something in place for our children and grandchildren. And the investment in research is that kind of long-term thinking that represents that attention to the needs of our children and grandchildren, and that we need to have a balanced policy. Yes, some resources for investment today, but some resources for the kind of research that will generate new solutions for the future. Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members.
Thank you, Senator Kelly. Any questions? I would like to make a comment, since I see no questions, that I view earmarks a little different than maybe many people here, so maybe we have some overlap there, but I view earmarks as being very much needed. I don't believe in pork. The 35W bridge was an earmark. It was not pork. Sometimes we need to point to a project to get the project done. So, all right. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
We'll move on to...
Yeah, take it easy. Yeah.
We'll move on to Jonathan Foley. Welcome, Mr. Foley.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chairman and members. Thank you for the opportunity to be here today to speak to you about this issue. I'm Jonathan Foley. I'm the director of the Institute on the Environment at the University of Minnesota, which manages the IRE program, our Initiative for Renewable Energy and the Environment. And I'm also an Xcel ratepayer, like many of us in the Twin Cities. I'm going to cover 4 points, which kind of follow on those of Senator Kelly and the points raised by Dick Hemmingson, who was here, I believe, about a week ago. And so my comments will be brief into these 4 main points. Point number one is essentially that we believe that innovation is really a key to success in Minnesota in the long term. We can make a choice, basically, a choice between a consumer of renewable energy technology and buy stuff from China, Germany, and elsewhere and plunk it in the ground in Minnesota, or we can produce that technology here. And in the long run, producing that kind of technology here in Minnesota is what would guarantee the long-term economic prosperity and job creation we seek here in Minnesota. We've been working very hard at that at the university for many years now, especially in the last 9 years through the IRE program. You've heard the details of IRE before. I won't go through the details of it in long detail. But just to remind you that this has been an extremely successful program that has generated hundreds of new projects It has led to major new patents and discoveries and publications that have been world-renowned. Some of the most important work in energy has happened thanks to this. It has brought $70 million of other funding into Minnesota that were in addition to the Renewable Development Fund dollars, huge amount of leverage from external money, which is fantastic. We estimate that it's created well over 300 new high-tech jobs in Minnesota, mainly technicians and researchers, but a lot of these people came here to Minnesota to take these jobs, are talented high-tech workers that we need for this state to prosper in the future. So rather than being a brain drain, we see a brain magnet being created by the university. We've created 195 partnerships with businesses and nonprofits across the state, from Fortune 500s to new startups. We're starting a new consortia between businesses and the university in wind, polymers, and many, many other fields. And because of this foundation, now Minnesota ranks among the best universities in the world for energy research. That was not true 9 years ago, but thanks to IRE, it is now true. So we're mentioned in the same breath with MIT and Stanford and Berkeley as a go-to place for renewable energy. So that's a big success, but it took a long time to get there. And one of the points that we want to make is that we don't want, as Senator Kelly mentioned, we don't want to lose our momentum now. We've built a foundation. We've gained a lot of momentum, a lot of credibility, and a lot of success. And it would be a shame for that investment to now suddenly disappear. So we'd really encourage the legislature in thinking about the renewal of the RDF to make sure that there is still a continued investment in appropriate R&D technology and innovation for Minnesota's energy future. It's crucial. Second major point is how you manage R&D and innovation is very different than how you might manage procurement. If you want to build a power line or you want to build a wind farm or a solar panel facility, you do one thing. You hire a consultant to evaluate the project. You set a schedule of deliverables and work progress and payments, and that's exactly how you should do that. What's being proposed by Xcel is very reasonable when it comes to those kinds of activities. But for research, that is not how you do it. Research and innovation doesn't happen on a monthly timetable with deliverables and work schedules like that. That's not how it works. We've created a different process because we realize one size doesn't fit all, and it's a process modeled after the best peer review process in the world, the National Institutes of Health, the National Science Foundation, and Department of Energy. It is light on administration. We do not have heavy reporting requirements to scientists and engineers because they'll walk home. They don't want to participate in stuff like that. It's very nimble and able to identify new opportunities that come up often within days to leverage a big federal grant opportunity or a major foundation elsewhere in the world. In many cases, we're responding within hours to an opportunity somewhere else in the world, helping our investigators leverage their grants against others. It's focused on quality and impact. We take peer reviewers from all over the world. Again, as Senator Kelly mentioned, we can access the best scientists and engineers in the world, where a consultant typically cannot even get close. Because they respect us, we respect them, we're peers with them, we know how to get to them. So we can get the best quality peer review of science and engineering proposals the world has to offer and ask, what is it in terms of good science, but also, is this going to impact Minnesota in terms of jobs, the economy, and energy security, which is, after all, our mission. So we take that approach, and it's operating very differently than you might do for maybe a procurement process, which a different process would be needed. Bottom line is, one size doesn't fit all. You need multiple approaches. My third point would be that we have an opportunity here, basically a Silicon Valley opportunity. Now, that sounds a little grandiose, I'll admit, but think about it. When Silicon Valley started, what did they have? They had some business leaders, a couple of investors, and they had a major research university. What they had that we didn't is the ability to connect the pieces together. That's what's crucial. And that's what we're asking for here. It's Minnesota, with its big business climate, its small-time entrepreneurs, its high-tech startups, everything right here in a vibrant business community, second to none. We have world-class leadership in agriculture, in food, and forest resources in the state. We have global investment and transportation hubs here. And we have world-class research universities, especially in energy. Not only that, we also have some of the most abundant natural resources in the country in terms of renewable energy, wind, solar, biomass, et cetera. So what we're hoping for is that what IRE has done so far is to build, mainly in the research and development community, what we call an innovation ecosystem, building these connections. Again, we don't feel this can happen solely with one player in the RDF. We need to connect business and research and investment to build that kind of Silicon Valley-like entity that we need in Minnesota. We've started to do that in IRE. We need to continue to do that. We believe that much more effort is needed along these lines, and we encourage the legislature to keep this in mind, that collaboration between business research entities must happen for this to be fruitful. My final point is that clearly in the discussions about the Renewable Development Fund, many questions have been asked, and we think that a coordinated and shared approach to running this program is the best approach. The questions have been raised so far about, you know, how should this fund be managed? How do we avoid having silos and kind of the many-headed monster some people have referred to of individual programs pursuing their own agendas separately? How do we maintain accountability and transparency to the legislature and to ratepayers? And importantly, most of all, is how do we get the job done? We believe that the RDF going forward really needs to consider all of these points. But our plea to you is to consider the following, that there should be a designated and dedicated program for innovative research and development in the RDF. It's crucial to the long-term success of Minnesota. Again, we can buy and consume renewable energy technology, or we can produce it. I think we should do the latter. We should build on the existing success of what we already have, the long momentum we've built for several years through IRE, and leverage our, you know, fantastic institutions that the state has already invested in, whether it's our universities, our businesses, and so on, and make sure that those are leveraged together and work forward in a coordinated way. We need a nimble, effective process for managing R&D, not, you know, recognizing that it's not the same thing as procurement, and that we basically have a responsive system that knows how to work with innovation and research and can get the job done effectively. But this also needs to be cooperatively managed. In the previous years in the RDF, we had separate silos that were not coordinated. We feel that that was maybe something that was a lost opportunity. And moving forward, we should seize the opportunity of coordinating better different parts in RDF. So we look forward to seeing how we could design a system that allows for different approaches for research and procurement, but also for them to be coordinated together with the least transaction cost and the most maximum outcomes. So in light of that, we recommend a cooperative managed strategy that's coordinating between Xcel and other players in the RDF and be accountable to ratepayers in the state. In the end, the University of Minnesota is just standing ready to be an active partner in whatever is designed here moving forward. We have a lot of experience in R&D and pushing innovation forward. We know how to do it. We have the momentum. We have a huge amount of success. And we continue to want to serve the state of Minnesota in the best of our ability. And we look forward to finding ways to do that. Thank you for your time and attention today.
Thank you, Mr. Foley. Any questions? Senator Jungbaugh.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Must be getting weaker in my old age. That last birthday was a killer, I guess. Mr. Foley, thank you. And those that know me know I love innovation. I love research. The problem is, as legislators, we have to deal with auditors and people looking over our shoulders saying, you're running this program right, you're running this program wrong. Is there a way to restructure outcomes of IRE to show a return on investment to the auditor, to show something back to the ratepayers that we can, you know, give the auditor what they're looking for? Can you give us that?
Madam Chair, Senator Jungbauer, that's an excellent question. We believe we have made a significant return on investment. We can track precisely the number of dollars that we've leveraged from the RDF and how we've multiplied that hugely, more than any other part of the RDF, and how all that money is being spent here in Minnesota. We are also trying to track the number of jobs that were created both within and outside the university and the number of partnerships we're creating. So we're not just funding projects, we're also stewarding them and making sure that as scientists and engineers get projects underway that we find actively connect them to business partners in the state to get that additional value add. So we track that. What we perhaps need to do better is communicate that better to you all and to ratepayers, and that was the point of the legislative auditor.
Senator Jungbaugh.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and Mr. Foley. Yes, I've been very impressed and been one of the legislators that goes over to the university and sees the awards and the different research and patents that have been developed, the great things you're doing over there. And you say that, you know, you haven't maybe communicated it to us, but obviously to the auditor as well. And so I guess part of when we're looking through some of the reports, too, when we were looking at some of the money things, and I think it varies from project to project, But it looked in some of the reports as though some of the administrative costs ran around 50% or could have even exceeded 50%. Does every project run different? And
Madam Chair, Senator, I'm not sure what numbers you're referring to. That is, to my knowledge, and I'm responsible for those budgets in our institute, that is definitely not the case. The administrative costs are far, far, far lower than that. I don't know. I'd have to see what you're referring to, but if you would send me that later or talk about it offline, I'll make sure that we send you the details on that. But I'm not sure what you're referring to, but our administrative costs are never even remotely close to that. Heads would roll if that were the case, I can assure you. So we are a lean and mean operation. That is definitely nowhere near that.
And Senator Jungberg.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Foley, yes, we, you know, sometimes reports could get, I guess, numbers could be wrong in some of the things we see, so it would be good to sit down offline and look at some of the things because, again, we go back and forth between auditors and some of the other information that comes before us, and many times we can't study everything, although I'm one of those guys that loves to study everything. So I guess that would be, you know, I've talked to Mr. Hemmingson many times about coming up with that direct connection, and Senator Kelly talked about different things that do have a connection, but I think if we are to move forward at all with this partnership, we need those things defined, and I think we haven't seen that kind of stuff in writing as to how can we make sure we're covered in what the auditor's requesting and things. So I would ask you to try to help us as we look through the rest of this.
Mr. Foley.
Yep, Madam Chair. Senator, yes, of course, we'll be happy to do that. We've responded to the legislative auditor's report, I think, pretty thoroughly at the time, but if there are lingering issues on these particular points, we would be happy to address them with you individually or with the committee and look forward to doing so.
Mr. Foley, I'm sorry I missed the earlier part of your testimony and Senator Kelly's testimony, but how can you just reiterate again how you responded to the OLA's request? Because I believe that the OLA's report came out. Mm-hmm. It's been over a year, and we put a freeze on this bill. Obviously, I would assume you would have looked at your expenses, administrative cost, operations, salaries, all that, fully knowing that that was going to be an issue here in this committee and in the future RDF legislation. So I just came in to hear you say what you need, what IRE needs from the RDF fund, mm-hmm. the changes it needs. But can you tell me what you're going to do to change to fit into the designated requirements of this fund going forward?
Excuse me. Yeah, Madam Chair. At the time of the OLA report, and I should ask my colleagues, Dick Hemmingson and others, to speak up if I misquote some of this, we very carefully worked with the OLA office, of course, and we responded in the report and the appendix. There is a letter of our response there. Off the top of my head, I'd have to get the precise figures to you later. We've, of course, been tracking this from day one, not just for their report, for our own as well. Our administrative costs are always well under 10%. I have no idea where this 50% number came from. I don't think that's in the OLA report. We'll have to double-check where that is. So we do know that that's, you know, an issue, but it's a very, very manageable one. We can definitely be following on that. The other issues that were raised, though, were really about, I think the larger issues raised by the auditor, and I think that have been in discussions with members of this committee, have really been about the consolidation of, instead of having three different components of the RDF, rather having maybe one or something like that. And we see the point that, yes, more coordination, more kind of singular accountability and transparency of the entire RDF is extremely desirable. And I think that was the major point of the OLA report and one I've heard members make here. However, our point in return is that there's not always one solution to every problem. Like the solution for procuring a power line or building a wind farm is one process. A process for innovation and research is a different one. And we have, through a lot of hard work, have built a fantastic process as a national model here at the university. And we believe that it would be a shame to just eliminate that experience and the momentum and the reputation that has already been built. And so what we hope to do here is to find a way to And we don't want to prescribe a solution. It's the legislature's job to see how to best structure this. But the university says, you know, we want to stand ready to be an ally in moving forward, and we have a lot of experience in R&D investments and how to manage them. We have a world-class reputation in both the outcomes of this, but also the process of managing it. And also in terms of the science itself, we've taken Minnesota from being a sleepy kind of nowhere school on energy and have now become one of the best renewable energy universities in the world. There are other assets within the state also that we need to tap as well, the Minsky system, other private colleges and universities, research institutes and companies and so on that could broaden this expertise further. So we have a lot of work to do, but we have an incredible foundation upon which to build.
Mr. Foley, how long have you been receiving IRE funding?
Myself, never. I'm the director of the Institute on the Environment that manages the IRE Fund. IRE has been in existence for 9 years at the university, and I've been at the university for three, roughly.
Mm-hmm. And so this collaborative measure or thought has not come into existence until your funding has been threatened? That troubles me, Mr. Foley, that I guess I'd like to know how much you IRE has received from Excel. What's the current value that you've received from Excel's program here to date?
Madam Chair, we currently receive roughly $5 million through the Renewable Development Fund annually. That's been for the last several years. The total amount is somewhere closer to $30 million, I believe, over the entirety of the program. I believe that number is correct. Is it? Okay, it's a little bit higher than that. So that's all in the annual report that you have in front of you, I believe. I think an important point to make is IRE's been, from day one, always been a collaborative venture. We have always connected research projects to businesses across the state. I don't think that's a fair characterization at all. From day one, IRE has made connections from the university to companies and startups and investors across the state and across the nation. We've made connections to national labs. We've made connections to other researchers and other institutions. So I believe I misspoke if you think I was trying to say that this is now the time we're thinking about partnerships beyond the university. We've been thinking about that since day one, and I believe we've done a very good job of that. We have over 195 different partnerships we've already created across the state. We've created one of the nation's best wind power research consortia with 3M, Honeywell, WindLogic, and so on as major partners to this, and landed an $8 million federal grant to Minnesota thanks to that partnership. We're doing the same thing in the Center for Sustainable Polymers, where Minnesota is an active leader in this area. Thanks to early work by Cargill and others. So we work with many different groups, including the Minnesota corn growers as well, and many, you know, not just companies, but grower groups, commodities groups, NGOs, and so on. So, again, I think our success is that we've had 200 partnerships. I think we can do more. So I maybe misspoke if that's what you heard. But we've certainly had plenty of partnerships before.
Well, that's what I heard, Mr. Foley. And I'd just like to know, how much of the RDF dollars has been used for the advancement of renewable energy? I mean, can you have this pot of money, mm-hmm. and it's to whatever programs, and I know they have been very good, you know, trust me, I understand that. You've done some wonderful research. But the pot of money from the XL ratepayers is specifically supposed to be used for the advancement of renewable energy.
Mm-hmm.
Can you say that that's exactly what it's been used for?
Yes, of course. That is the mandate we were given by previous legislatures, so we followed it to the letter. Our mandate has always been to advance renewable energy research and development, which is part of the entirety of an investment that you need for Minnesota to have a vibrant renewable energy economy. Again, as you might have missed my earlier comments, but we have part of the portfolio that is consuming renewable energy technology. We're producing renewable energy technology, and we believe that that's crucial for the long-term viability of the energy economy in Minnesota. So we don't believe that should be the entirety of the RDF should be focusing on innovation and research, but a fraction of it, which it has been. So, yes, all of the investment we make is in renewable energy. We are following the legislative language very precisely. Every grant is reviewed again and again with respect to that and measured in its impact against those criteria. So it must be.
So then, Mr. Foley, why would you be opposed for it going through the RDF board, the advisory, and the PUC if all those programs are geared towards renewable energy? What would be the problem with it going through the normal course of action?
Madam Chair, I'm sorry that you missed some of my earlier comments where I tried to address that particularly. Let me quickly review that. My point here is that my colleague, Senator Kelly, will join me here too, I believe.
Welcome, Senator Kelly, again.
So a key issue here is that the process that we use for evaluating and choosing research projects is very different than the process that is typically used in the RDF for procurement of goods and services. If you're trying to build a power line or a windmill or something like that, you have one process that works very well with a particular schedule of deliverables and payments on a monthly schedule. But if you're trying to select the best research projects in the university or across the world, you need a different process. We follow the process that's been taken years to figure out at the National Science Foundation, National Institutes of Health, and so on, with world-class peer reviewers, where it's based on scientific judgment of engineering, science and engineering excellence, as well as the impact to mission, which is to benefit Minnesota's economy, renewable energy standards, and energy security of the state.
Senator Kelly.
Madam Chair, I appreciate the opportunity to revisit a point I made earlier. I probably wouldn't, when I was in the legislature, probably would have been asking some of the same questions that you've been asking. But having been on the inside of the university for a while and having had a chance to try to see it from both perspectives, here's what I think I see about the difference in the process. My colleagues at the university who do the scientific research are really, they are super busy people. I know because I try to keep up with them, and it's a challenge. And so they're making evaluations about where to submit proposals, where there's a chance of actually getting the grant money. And they understand the kinds of processes that the National Science Foundation uses or the Department of Energy or IRE. And so I think it is my opinion, based on what I've seen, that it's that scientific understanding of the IRE process that has produced so many grant applications. And I don't think that those individual scientists will send as many proposals to an external process run by Princeton Energy, for example, because they don't have any reason to trust Princeton Energy and the process that they use compared to the ones that they're comfortable with. And if there's a perception that it's political and that a scientific proposal is in competition with a proposal for building, you know, as meritorious as it might be, a solar panel facility or a new wind farm or something like that, they're going to see that it's not the same as being in competition with other research projects for funding. And that's where I disagree with the legislative auditor's argument that you can use the same process successfully for evaluating scientific projects and construction projects. And it is not so much about the University of Minnesota. It's about the behavior of scientists who will seek grants under the proposal. And so I think that's the key difference that the legislative auditor didn't keep in mind in arguing for a single allocation process. And I think what Mr. Foley was proposing, not because nobody thought of it before, but in response to the legislative auditor's assertion that there should be more accountability in the proposal, in the whole operation of the RDF, that finding ways to coordinate the research funding with the construction funding is a perfectly legitimate recommendation from the legislative auditor. And I think what Dr. Foley is suggesting is that that's something that the university is interested in pursuing with you, Madam Chair, and the members of the committee. And the question is how to draft that so that we can get the benefits of coordination across the RDF and the benefits of scientific research process that a range of researchers will trust and will respond to with their best ideas.
Well, you can imagine the pickle we're in, Senator Kelly.
Well,
we are trying to be responsible with these ratepayers' dollars. We're trying to, you know, this is not a state fund. This is a public fund, or a private fund, excuse me. And so we have to look at measures of accountability and late stage, knowing that there is a return on the investment. You know, we have to look at is there just this pot of money? We really know nothing about how do you just have a pot of money sitting over there for just in case you might get a federal grant. I mean, this is a serious thing. So you can understand that there is some trepidation, Senator Kelly.
Well, and Madam Chair, I think one of the advantages of conducting this review at this point in the history of IRE is that you aren't betting on a future promise. The IRE process has demonstrated that IRE research grants are high enough quality that the researchers then take what they've done and they go and get other grants from external processes like the National Science Foundation or the Department of Energy. So our researchers have demonstrated the success in doing this. So past performance is no guarantee of future outcome. But at least in this case, we've demonstrated that we've got a project that does produce a process that does produce results and that the University of Minnesota researchers can compete internationally. When we were in Germany last summer talking to German experts on geothermal technology, they knew about Professor Martin Saar and the research that he was doing in Minnesota with IRE-funded resources. So these are internationally known projects that have the potential for significant payoffs to Minnesotans. And as an Xcel ratepayer, I couldn't agree more with the need for accountability.
Senator Dibble.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Senator Kelly or Mr. Foley, let me maybe try to rephrase and reframe a little bit about what you're trying to communicate to us and see if I'm understanding correctly. Is it fair to say that the suggestion that you're bringing forward is to allow for the designation of these funds to IRE, but also to figure out a process by which perhaps that designation of funds is subjected to somewhat, a similar process as the individual grants process. For example, it would go through the committee, the advisory committee embedded within Xcel that's been established, you know, passed to the PUC, but nevertheless would come forward as a block grant or, you know, as a chunk of money, then placed in IRE's hands, and it's money that would currently serve its current purpose, which is a pot of dollars that are nimble and flexible, and the dollars which IRE uses, you know, kind of as the core of the way it conducts its business to provide those seed dollars, those matching grants, those little startup research, but to also perhaps be responsive to some of the findings of the auditor and some of the criticisms of, you know, how loose our statutory structure is now around the RDF, so that there is more accountability to the PUC, more accountability to Xcel and the advisory committee, more accountability to the ratepayers and the legislature around consistency and alignment with how those dollars are used and what the outcomes are. Is that a fair summary of what you've tried to present?
Mr. Foley.
Madam Chair, Senator Dibble, that's an excellent question, and thank you for asking that, because it gives us an opportunity to follow up on a point that's very crucial here, I think. In my testimony here, the points that we were trying to make is that clearly innovation pays off. IRE, as Senator Kelly's pointed out, is a proven commodity. We know how to do this. It has been hugely beneficial to Minnesota and has returned tens of millions of dollars and many hundreds of jobs to the state of Minnesota already. So we know that it works. The second point is we know that the process we're using does work too, that this process of selecting research grants, very different than what Excel's proposing, works for research, and it's very different than for construction. Those are the points that we really think are founding principles for moving forward. Your point, Senator, I think is an excellent one, is how that is governed, how this is actually organized, could be very different than the way it is today. In fact, we would endorse and be very happy with a single governance structure, perhaps, you know, under just one umbrella organization of which we would be a participant, but not necessarily a separate entity from like we are today. So until now, there have been basically three different entities that all had different reporting structures, different charges, and different modes of accountability. I think that's actually led to the loss of opportunity of collaboration, of full accountability and transparency to you and to ratepayers. And the legislative auditor is quite correct, in my opinion, in pointing that out. And we agree. So moving forward, our main point is that there should be a role for research and development. The university knows how to do this, and we're offering that experience to you in a restructured RDF, the form of which we believe it's the legislature's job is to decide what that should look like. It does not have to look like it does today. Mm-hmm. And to your point, a single overarching entity with a single board and a single set of rules would be very reasonable for us. In fact, might have very good outcomes of more collaborative opportunities. So we would look forward to being a partner. We're not trying to protect our turf or just to keep a silo operating. That's not our job. We want to see innovation happen, and we know how to do it. So it's an offer. It's not a request to maintain status quo.
And we do need to keep moving, yeah. Senator Kelly.
Madam Chairman and Senator Dibble, just a quick response, too. I mean, you can take the draft that Senator Rosen has circulated and see places where connections could be made. For example, you wouldn't want an external body making individual research grants. On the other hand, in terms of establishing research priorities, do we pay more attention to research into storage, for example, or things like that? Working with the advisory group that's described in the legislation would make a lot of sense in terms of connections between the grant making process and how do we decide on priorities. So there are places, and then on the reporting side, there are several provisions in the draft language that reflect things that IRE has been seeking to do, I think, but which can always be made better, and which having it in the language seems perfectly appropriate. So I think the challenge is differentiating priority setting from actual grant making.
Senator Dibble.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So is it fair to say, Senator Kelly or Mr. Foley, that I don't know how many discrete research projects we're talking about in the typical year that IRE might use these dollars for. I assume it's dozens, many dozens, I don't know.
It's about 100 or so.
Okay, 100. So is it fair to say that if, in fact, this $5 million, or, if IRE were to simply, ignore the $5 million, IRE didn't get this $5 million kind of in this block grant form, and each of those 100 discrete research projects had then go through this RDF, established RDF process, they probably wouldn't occur. I mean, those dollars just simply wouldn't be available for those purposes. Maybe a few would, but you wouldn't be able to deploy those resources in the manner and the way and in a timely enough way to really do the core of what IRE does.
Madam Chair,
Mr. Foley,
Senator, yeah, I believe that's the case. I don't know enough about the process the RDF has been using, but I one to Senator Kelly's point, it's extremely onerous, and researchers won't go there. Second, we would flood them. We handle about 100 applications a year, far more than the rest of the RDF does. Many of them are very small grants or seed grants. We do a lot of work to make sure that workflow happens. But there are ways, I think, that this process could live within a larger single RDF structure. To Senator Kelly's point, even within the draft language that's being circulated, for the renewal of the RDF, we see opportunities for what we do to fit very easily within that, to be a subcomponent within that, where there's kind of accountability, transparency, and governance would remain the same overall, but there would be a part of the RDF designated for research that would operate in a different kind of peer review process and nimbleness. So I think there's a real win-win opportunity here for a lot of the things we all want to happen, and we're stand ready to help do that, that we basically have the know-how and the process to operate that kind of research program within a larger RDF, and it could be done efficiently and under one umbrella.
Senator Benson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I was reviewing the draft legislation as well, and I was not involved in the drafting, and so maybe you, Madam Chair, can help me understand. But I don't see anything that prohibits the advisory group or the PUC from doing a block grant with sufficient support and evidence that that would be well used and reported back. And so I don't necessarily think we need to create a subcategory in legislation specifically for this. But if we wanted to address the research issue, maybe the University of Mankato wants to apply for a grant for energy. Mm-hmm. And so I'm putting this out there as part of the discussion because the grant process in the scientific community has to be reasonably nimble, but I don't see anything in the legislation that would actually prohibit that. And so perhaps further discussions and understanding if that would if the advisory board with Excel would be amenable.
I agree with you, Senator Benson. I agree with you 100% on that one. Any other questions for the two? Good. We're going to keep moving. Thank you, Mr. Foley and Senator Kelly.
Thank you.
Mr. Hinkle. Welcome.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. I appreciate the opportunity to address you this afternoon and convey to you some of the concerns, opportunities that the Minnesota Solar Energy Industry Association, which I represent, believes are evident in the draft language that we're considering today. My name is Lynn Hinkle. I'm the policy director for Minnesota Solar Energy Industry Association, which represents business entities all across the state throughout the entire solar value chain, meaning we represent installers, contractors, manufacturers, both OEMs, original equipment manufacturers, a significant number of manufacturers who are in the solar manufacturing supply chain. We represent training facilities and a number of trade unions who are associated with contractors and installers are involved in Mencia as well. We're really excited about what's happening with solar in our state, and we believe that it's the next major economic development cluster to develop in Minnesota, provided certain policy signals and other policies are put in place. If you'd indulge me for just a moment, I'd like to put my comments about the RDF draft language in context. We're in the process, as I said, of trying to create an economic development cluster in the state, a solar cluster, and we're approaching this on four fronts. I just talked a little bit about the solar manufacturing supply chain in the state. That's our first major front, is to dramatically facilitate the development of the solar manufacturing supply chain in the state. And to this end, we've been working very hard over the last year. Many of you have attended or at least know about the solar manufacturing supply chain roundtables that have been convened four times, starting in December of 2010 and as recently as 2 weeks ago at the University of Minnesota. And in between, there was a meeting at 3M June 1st, and prior to that, we've had meetings at the Deed headquarters in downtown St. Paul. This is facilitating the linkage, the building of links in the value chain internally. Hundreds of manufacturers and suppliers in the state have been able to take advantage of this, and we're in the process of seeing how the industry is beginning to scale up in the state. But one thing that's really clear to those folks and is communicated to myself and other folks in Mencia is that as robust as the supply chain is and as important as their ability to do exports to not just other parts of the country but to participate in the global market is to them, they need a demand signal that corresponds and complements the work that they're doing in manufacturing in the state. So what are we doing about that? Three things. We're working right now to increase demand for renewable energy, solar, combined with energy efficiency as part of the governor's executive order 11-12. And what that's doing is creating opportunities for guaranteed energy savings projects on public buildings throughout the state, and that's beginning to move. What you see here is private capital paired up with private companies on public buildings to generate good family-sustaining jobs across the state. Number two, we're scaling up the adoption of PACE commercial and industrial programs throughout the state. And many of you were in this room in 2010 when we passed the PACE-enabling legislation. It hit pause because of some problems with residential funding and financing. But we've continued to work on commercial and industrial adoption in this state, and we've currently begun to see some real uptake and successes in adoption at the local level. Edina most recently, we had a really successful meeting with folks from Northfield, with our partners, the Chamber of Commerce, last Friday. And in fact, I'll be giving a presentation with the Chamber to the Woodbury City Council tomorrow about adopting a program in Woodbury for commercial industrial PACE. And what that is, essentially, it's private capital with private companies on private buildings generating good family-sustaining jobs across the state. The third thing, and this gets to the heart of why I'm here today, is to increase funding for solar on public buildings. I have to say that on some level that seems like a very accessible and very attainable goal. We'd suggest that throughout the draft that we've been given, there are several opportunities to insert or to include language, both in the draft of the RDF and the REPI language. I don't recall any discussion of that prior to my testimony today, but that language to the effect that there should be opportunities for the installation of renewable energy resources on public buildings in the state, that becomes an opportunity that we fold into and craft in the language going forward. I can't imagine there being a great deal of opposition because I've talked to many of the legislators seated around this table this afternoon about what they see are some of the existing and real opportunities for their constituents on public buildings and schools in their districts. It seems on some level like that should be a reasonable process for us and other stakeholders to sit down and craft language that would create those opportunities throughout the state.
Mr. Hinkle.
Yes.
If you don't mind, I have to tell you, this has been an interesting exercise because you were in my office last week or the week before, and I did show you the language, and you agreed that the language was open for that very use on lines 2.7 to 2.10. Clearly says develop near commercial and demonstration scale renewable electric or electric infrastructure efficiency projects beneficial to the public utilities ratepayers. And is there something in there that does not allow these solar scale projects to be on public buildings. I guess I'm a little perplexed why you would come back this week and say you need to have it specifically spelled out in this this bill form, and that's exactly what we're trying not to do. We're trying to make everybody come to the table evenly, and that the merits of these proposals move forward by the advisory group and the PUC. So with all due respect, I'm a little surprised that you'd come back and say, no, we had a very clear discussion in my office about this.
I appreciated the opportunity to discuss the language with yourself a week and a half ago. I think there are opportunities for the existing language as it's been drafted. I agree that it could be broadly, and it may be broad enough to include that. Our concern was that having that language that, and it could be as general as an inclusion in the purpose language here that says including public buildings. It may not need to be inserted in other parts of the draft. We saw that as a way to help increase, buy-in and increase the support for these kind of programs. And that's our intent. And if that intent doesn't come across, there are opportunities, we believe, to sit down with yourself and staff to, craft what we think would help to facilitate greater support for the RDF going forward. That was our intent.
Well, I appreciate that. And I'm not here saying that this is a perfect piece of language here at all, but I'm just saying that I'm a little shocked, frankly, that that clearly what we've been avoiding is these earmarks or specific focus on a specific renewable energy source. I'm actually the one that has been jumping up and down about these solar panels on public buildings. I've been the one that wanted that but had to scale back on her goals going forward. So I think your project, your agenda, your focus is clear, and it would stand up against any other program if it went through the advisory group. But we will continue to talk. But I'm just a little surprised. That's all. Because you were excited about the language in my office 10 days ago.
It's true.
And you were very grateful.
And I remain excited about the overall content. I'm not sitting here saying we have a whole lot of changes that we're suggesting to be made.
Right.
The only other one is that there may be an opportunity. There's a couple of tweaks, but I don't see them as being major. But there may be an opportunity to discuss some electricity offsetting as well, so that an unintended consequence would be to avoid excluding solar thermal technologies, from being available or being eligible, for funding under the RDF. Again, this is not something that we or anticipated we would, sit through and, try to craft, at this point, but giving you some sense of the two or three places that we felt were opportunities to sit down and enhance.
Okay.
Because I totally agree that, we had a great discussion. We were enthusiastic about where we saw this headed. And I think it was the result of having some preliminary discussions with your staff and other folks that some of that language came back to us or reflected some of those positive discussions, those constructive dialogues that we had with folks. So I'm not here, at the least suggesting that that process was negative or is headed in the wrong direction.
Okay.
It's actually based on that I felt fairly comfortable saying, well, let's, continue that dialogue and that kind of discussion going forward.
Greatly appreciated. Thank you, Mr. Hinkle. Any questions? Appreciate it. Thank you very much, Mr. Hinkle. Members and folks in the audience, we've got three more people we'd like to hear some from, so we're going to go a little bit longer. We'll try to expedite this. But at this point, Ben Gerber from the Minnesota Chamber of Commerce, please. Welcome, Mr. Gerber.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. I appreciate you having me here today. and spending some time on this very important issue. I just want to address a few things that I heard today, and one of them I think goes to some of the concern we have as we represent XL ratepayers. I myself am an XL ratepayer, and we did hear a former senator make a comment that he is an XL ratepayer, but he also has property in Lake Country. And I hope he was saying this jokingly, and I believe it still is in poor taste, by saying that, you know, a lot of our businesses and a lot of the people in the state of Minnesota don't have the ability to have two homes or the ability to own two pieces of property. And so by everybody paying into that fund, all the XL ratepayers and the money distributed across the state of Minnesota, that bothers us. And as a representative of specifically business payers, we see that as an issue. And I hope that was a joke, but I really think that's something that the committee should take a look at when we have people administering the funds that make comments like that in front of a legislative committee. The second issue that I'd like to point out is when you look at the OLA report, you do see that Xcel Energy acknowledges the role of the RDF and Xcel ratepayers, and I believe that Rick Evans did a great job representing that. He did thank the ratepayers. Nowhere in the testimony of Irie or in the written testimony that we see is there ever mention that their funding comes from Xcel ratepayers, and that's bothersome as well. This is a private fund administered by Xcel. The legislature, as you can see with criticism by the OLA, has made direct appropriations out of it, and I believe this is one of the reasons we have the hearing and some of the draft language would address this issue. But you know, there's no acknowledgement that this is private people's money. Now, you know, it might only be a few cents to a few dollars a year on every bill, but in the aggregate, when you have people in downtown Minneapolis that may be having trouble paying their bills, this is money that they're paying that's going to fund this research. Now, we agree that I would disagree with the gentleman that testified that said that Minnesota was, I don't want to say he said it was nowhere, but it was a backwater of renewable research before the invention of IRE, but you know, there's a role that private businesses did play in this as well, and it wasn't just Irie. And I think we need to remember that these funds also went to private people that were nimble enough to apply for the program, and you know, they have businesses to run, and they were still able to do it. So I think, you know, we're not against Irie getting money. I don't think as a representative of the business community that are ratepayers, I don't think anyone would say the university doesn't deserve the money, but we don't believe that these funds should be specifically earmarked. And as the OLA report makes clear, the Renewable Development Fund is used inconsistently. It's not held to acceptable transparency and accountability standards and rarely provides direct benefits to the people who pay for it, and that's Xcel ratepayers. And now I'd like there's a great study that was done, and I don't have a copy for everyone. I can provide it. And I'll make this short. The project, the Brookings Rockefeller Study on Projects on State and Metropolitan Innovation, Leveraging State Clean Energy Development Funds. And if you look at some of the funds, and a lot of these are directly administered by the state, so they're a little different. We're unique in that respect. The California PEER program saved ratepayers nearly $1 billion annually from energy efficiency research. They received 38 private dollars of private non-utility follow-on investment for every $1 of PEER funding. The Massachusetts Clean Energy Center anticipates that nearly 450 jobs will be created or retained in their state. By the third quarter of 2011, with just over 2 years of operating and $3.9 million in program expenditures, the Clean Energy Business Incubator Program has nurtured several hundred jobs in the state, produced 33 new products to serve the clean tech market, and assisted client companies in raising $41 million in private capital and attracting $11 million in federal funding. And I'd like to point out, well, I think it's commendable that Irie has brought 300 jobs. If you look at what they've actually brought, it's research jobs. We haven't seen any private sector growth, or at least it hasn't been pointed out. And when you see what these other states have done and the studies show, there's been extensive private sector benefit. I think that's concerning that we're appropriating this money and we're not seeing the benefit that other states have. And I'm not saying that's one organization's fault, but I think we really, as all of us as ratepayers, we need to consider the impact of this money, because this is people's money. It's not state funds, and even that's still people's taxpayers' money that goes into it. I think You know, I think we heard some questions about, and I'll end right now. You know, we heard some questions about representation on the board, and I think what's really important to hear where people ask, well, is one group dominate? One of the senators asked, is one group dominate, or can we have representation? What we really think representation on any board should 100% be ratepayers. These are the people whose Excel ratepayers, whose money is being used. They should be the ones that help steer the funding if the RDF is going to go forward.
Okay.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members of the committee. I appreciate it.
You made a very good point, Mr. Gerber, about the accountability measure. If IRE does funding does go forward, it would, I think, be prudent to make sure that there are jobs that are created, or what is the outcome, the return on investment. That's substantial. So I thank you. Any questions from the committee? Thank you, Mr. Gerber.
Thank you.
Director Bill Grant, please.
Madam Chair and committee members, for the record, Bill Grant, representing the Department of Commerce. And I want to start by thanking Senator Rosen for bringing the bill forward. We see it as a great first step in removing the moratorium and helping us move forward with an important area of investment in renewable energy in the state. I think the reason that the moratorium was put in place in the first place was your concern, our concern, raised by the Office of Legislative Auditor, that there were really two big concerns with the way the fund was going at that point. The first was in the area of governance, and the second was in the area of really having a defined purpose for the fund. I think your bill does a good job in both of those areas, first in describing the role of the advisory board and the role or lack thereof of the legislature in making funding decisions going forward. And in the area of purpose, I think it's very helpful that the bill clarifies that this is intended to fund renewable electricity projects. That was always my understanding from the very beginning of the fund, and this clarifies that in statute, and I think will avoid some of the detours that we've taken perhaps over the years. I understand that that you don't intend, Madam Chair, to pass the bill out of committee today, so we look forward to working with you and other stakeholders on this. I do have a couple of issues that I would raise as things to talk about as we go forward. The first involves the language that's stricken on the first page relative to contributions to the fund after plant operations cease. It would be our view, Madam Chair, that as long as there's nuclear waste stored on-site at Prairie Island and Monticello, payments to the fund should continue, and that really for the purposes that the fund was created initially, whether the plant continues to operate or not, as long as there's waste being stored there, we would think that there really is no material difference as far as the continued operation of the fund is concerned. Second area that I would raise is I would direct you to line 2.9 of the bill, and an earlier testifier raised this as well. We have some concerns about the use of the phrase electric infrastructure efficiency projects as not necessarily being consistent with the earlier directive above to expend the money on renewable electricity projects. We think that language could be refined to clarify its intent. Certainly, we would want there to be enough flexibility here to allow energy storage projects that support renewable electricity going forward to be eligible under the program. But we're a little concerned that electric infrastructure efficiency is too expansive a phrase and one that we ought to look at tightening up a bit. Third area I would mention is with respect to the language on page 3.9 to 3.11. And really, this is just a question at this point for me. It suggests that we rely on a cost-effectiveness standard within when analyzing projects within technology types. And I just want to make sure that when we apply that term, that that's really what we intend here. The thing that's differentiated the Renewable Development Fund from other utility resource acquisition projects is that we've gone out on the limb a little bit in terms of wanting to advance the state of the art. And whether that was in the form of research and development or in the form of projects that we wouldn't undertake normally with utility ratepayer dollars, but that we want, because this is intended as a learning exercise as much as anything, to really advance the state of knowledge about renewable energy that's replicable at a larger scale in Minnesota, that applying a strict cost-effectiveness test may not be the approach that we want to take in every case. Finally, Madam Chair and members, I wanted to encourage the language that you have on line 2.6, speaking of promoting the startup expansion and attraction of renewable electric energy projects. As others have mentioned, it would be good if we started looking at not just one-off project grants, either again in the R&D area or in the area of energy production, but that we actually start making investments in Minnesota companies that are starting up here or growing to meet a renewable energy market. And one of the things that I found interesting in the Brookings study that was mentioned by the earlier testifier and that your staff had helpfully provided to us earlier was that a number of other states are actually looking and have participated in making direct investments in companies as part of their programs. And I realize there are some complications with that as a utility-run fund, but it's something that I think bears further looking into, and I think the language here on 2.6 creates that opportunity. So I would encourage us to do some more thinking along those lines. So with that, Madam Chair, I'd be happy to take any questions and look forward to working with you and your staff.
I really appreciate your comments, Director Grant. I will say that the cost effective, we've had discussions on that. We'll continue to talk about that with you. The flexibility of the electric infrastructure efficiency projects, it probably would have been easier just to go ahead and do my own thing and stick the bill in, because this is a moving target. But and keeping in mind the oil reports, and that it is a private fund. So I do appreciate your comments, and I think we're going to continue to talk, and move forward. I'm sure there'll be some changes. Senator Howe.
Madam Chair, Commissioner Grant, I just wanted to thank you for those comments, especially as it relates to the RDF. It's not about electric generation. It's about nuclear storage. And with what's happening at the federal level, with the current administration decision to move away from a national repository in Yucca Mountain, the General Accounting Office is suggesting that we might be planning for this for up to 500 years. So I would echo the same comments that this RDF should be tied to the storage of high-level nuclear waste and not to electric generation.
Thank you, Senator. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
We'll be talking. And Mr. Rick Evans, I'd like to have you come up and make some comments, final comments, please, since this is a XL ratepayers fund.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, I'm Rick Evans with XL Energy Government Affairs. You know, I this has been a terrific discussion, and I think very enlightening, I hope, for you and certainly for me as I hear the various points of view. I really think to capture the problem that we have here, and this reiterates just what the legislative auditor said, this is a very unusual fund. This is not public money. This is private money. And it's been set up with the process that I described at length, I apologize, at the last hearing, to accomplish the purposes that were that this very unusual fund was established to achieve. And, you know, my buddy Senator Kelly gave me a hard time for calling them earmarks, but I think there's a point to be made there. We did think about what we were going to call them, and I didn't, frankly, think it was a pejorative. I'm kind of in Senator Jungbauer's camp on that, having been a former congressional aide. I like an earmark as well as the next guy. But we thought about, you know, when I really don't like something, I call it a raid on the fund. Ms. McKiernan told me I couldn't say that, so I didn't call it a raid. I started at one point calling it an appropriation, and she said, well, wait a second. The appropriation is what you do with public money. It's not what you do with private money, so I couldn't call it an appropriation, so I landed on earmarks. I apologize if that, you know, was not the right term. But I don't know what to call it because this is a private fund, and it's supposed to be making grants under the process that we described in order to achieve the purposes it was set up for. I want to say, and I think I said it before, if I didn't say it strongly enough, I'll say it again. I do not sit here to criticize the University of Minnesota's program. It's obviously a terrific program. But it's a state program. It's a state university program. If back in 1994 the legislature wanted to appropriate a tax on nuclear spent fuel and use it to fund higher education, they certainly were able to do that. But that's not what they did. They set up this very unique fund, Renewable Development Fund, to be operated in the way it was. And so there's nothing certainly wrong with what the university has done with the money. I don't criticize their substance at all. But we have this problem of, you know, essentially treating this private money as if it were a state appropriation, which it's not. And not only do I think that puts us in an unusual position as we're supposed to be taking responsibility for this money, but just to reiterate the point that I made the last time, which is once you do that, and the history of the fund shows this quite dramatically. Once you do that the first time, there's no stopping. We've heard today, you know, the university's got some great ideas. Mr. Hinkle has some great ideas. Those are the first two of 100 great ideas that will line up at this table and say, why don't I get some too? And that's not what this fund is for. And as a result of that process, we've spent the last 4 years without even the ability to make grants because all the money's been taken. And so, you know, I look forward. I enjoyed the university's testimony today. I see an opportunity for there for us to sit down and work with them to see if there's some way that we can accommodate what I think are XL's legitimate concerns about the way the fund has been handled in the past. So I don't, you know, by any means think that you know, the way it's been done or the way I recommend it be done is the only way it can be done. But I do think it's important, as I think the chair pointed out rightly, this is private money set up in a very unusual situation with a very definitive process for its use. And once we start appropriating it, if not earmarking it, then that's what the legislature can do, and that's not appropriate for this private money, in my opinion. I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you, Mr. Evans. Senator Dibble.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Evans, do you see a role for research and development, you know, within the RDF, or do you just simply see a role for energy production?
Mr. Evans.
Madam Chair, Senator Dibble, that is one place where I think that we have to take the guidance from the committee. Mm-hmm. The legislature did set up the fund, this unusual fund that is private money, and the Public Utilities Commission, you know, is ultimately the public authority for spending the money. Now, we received some criticism, frankly, over in the other body last year in some of the discussion about spending too much of it on research. They wanted to see steel on the ground. And that came from both sides of the aisle and from all kinds of folks. I guess I'll be agnostic on it. I think that, you know, it's a good discussion. There's probably some balance there. We certainly have funded plenty of research projects through the RDF, through our process, to the point of actually receiving some criticism for the amount of that. So how we go about striking that right balance or just letting the process go, I guess I wouldn't be in favor of trying to segregate funds into two buckets because then it takes an act of Congress to if you get the balance wrong. But perhaps there's a way we can talk about doing that in some direction to the Public Utilities Commission.
Senator Dibble.
Thank you, Madam Chair and Mr. Evans, and yourself as well, Madam Chair. There's this refrain that this is private fund and private money, and And I agree that this is money that we as the legislature tell Xcel that they have to pay for a particular purpose, and so in that sense it is ratepayer money. But how is that different? We don't use this refrain, private fund, private money, when we talk about assessing the utilities for the purpose of paying for the operations of the Public Utilities Commission or assessing them for, you know, a number of other things as well. And there be a committee of whomever, not us, you know, directing exactly how those particular assessments, which are ratepayer dollars, are spent. We say quite specifically how those are spent. So what's the difference? I'm not quite getting why the refrain, this is private money and we don't really have a say, although we're saying here exactly how the money is going to be spent, at a minimum by what process. So what's the distinction here? I'm not getting that.
Mr. Evans.
Oh, Madam Chair, Senator Dibble, I think you're wrestling with the same problem that I opened speaking about, which the auditor is wrestling with, which is, you know, why is it the way it's set up certainly doesn't look like any other public money. I guess I would make, there is, you know, a specific assessment that's asserted against utilities to pay for public purposes, and they're very specific. I guess I would compare this more to our conservation improvement program spending requirements. That money is not taken by the state as an assessment or as a tax. Rather, we are directed, again, under the supervision of the Public Utilities Commission, to spend that money on certain functions, in that case, conservation, in this case, grant making for renewable development. So I guess part of the point is, the difference is, in this case and in the SIP case, we're the ones administering the money. We're not a public body. We're a private company. And the money never leaves our hands until it goes to the people who receive the grants. And that's different, I guess, from a tax or an assessment. I'm not sure it's a difference with a distinction, but it's obviously something, and that's what we're sort of wrestling with here.
Well, Senator Dibble.
Madam Chair, and Mr. Chairman, that's not entirely true. We do other assessments, and we give those dollars to other entities, and they spend those dollars, and we tell them how to spend those dollars. We do some assessments we give to the Department of Commerce. We do some assessments. We have the PUC. You know, we give it to the PUC. So the analogy is not entirely correct. Mr. Evans, why so much discomfort with some of the ideas that were presented by IREE, where we create, we acknowledge that perhaps we need some R&D money that can be chunked out in smaller pieces and be more nimble, more flexible, that we look to this kind of R&D, at a specific, with the proper process and a procedure that, goes through the Xcel Advisory Committee and then is, blessed by the PUC at some point and has some greater measure of accountability and oversight and alignment with the larger purposes and goals of the RDF, but, is recognized that doesn't have to go through each kind of cumbersome process, because there's hundreds of small projects that perhaps need dollars that are deployed much more effectively and nimbly for these kinds of purposes. And we contract with or whatever, we acknowledge that the IREE is probably the best place to do that, which has the larger and longer-term benefit of perhaps positioning Minnesota for much, much greater economic success on into the future.
Mr. Evans.
Oh, Madam Chair, Senator Dibble, I guess if I express nervousness, my nervousness is, how do we do this so that it stops here? But let me say, I heard it for the first time today, so I don't dismiss the idea out of hand at all. I look forward to talking with the university about how they might envision that happening. So I don't take my comments, please, as being necessarily negative. It's just I'm hearing it. I'd like to sit down and talk with them. I had a brief conversation with Mr. Iverson this morning, generally along these lines, and I'd like to continue that conversation. But again, my nervousness is, I don't want the next group and the next group and the next group to come in to the point where we no longer have a fund for us to administer, for us to do what we think the fund was intended for.
And frankly, Mr. Evans, this has been on the table for quite a while. It should have, like I said, been through the LEC hearings probably last fall, but it didn't. At least we're having some hearings right now. This proposal, Senator DeDibble, that you suggested, which actually, you know, let's talk about it. It should have come up a long time ago, because the University of Minnesota knew that this was that this entitlement, this standard, $5 million a year is cannot go on like that as status quo. It just can't, because as Mr. Evans says, you keep that there, then everybody else has an opportunity to be earmarked in this fund, and then there's nothing else for anybody that else that has a wonderful idea going forward, and we're back to square one. So we have to figure out how to move this thing forward. Otherwise, the other option is just to repeal the whole thing, and all the money goes back to the ratepayers. I mean, this is kind of where we're at right now, and I don't think that's where we want to go either. So I'm hoping that there's some compromise here, and appreciate your comments, Mr. Evans. I think it's got to be somewhat frustrating for you. I'm looking forward to seeing some of the proposals coming forward in the cycle four, see what's out there, since we haven't had one for a while, and just stay tuned, members, to see what this bill looks like. So I appreciate you staying longer.
Mr. Madam Chair, sadly for my friends, this is what I consider to be fun. So I
you need a life with that, yeah. Mr. Evans and members. And thank you very much for coming. Meeting adjourned.